Welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, where modern portfolio theory can suck it. A student of the school of Graham and Doddsville and a clergy member of the Church of Warren Buffett. Here's your host, Eric Schlein.
Hi, this is Eric Schlein. You are listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today we have Danielle Strachman here from the 1517 Fund. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Eric. I really appreciate being here.
Yeah, absolutely. And where are you calling from?
I am calling from Oakland, California. Some days I work out of Oakland, and the majority of the days I work out of San Francisco, so Bay Area overall.
Nice. That's not a bad area to work, huh?
No, definitely not.
Right on. So tell us a little bit about, like, what is the 1517 Fund, first of all? Like, you know.
Sure. Yeah, happy to give you a primer. So 1517 Fund, we're a small venture capital fund here in the Bay Area, founded by myself and my colleague Michael Gibson. We also work with Nick Arnett, who is our community partner, and Zach Slayback, who is our marketing partner. And we started, you know, Michael and I started the fund 3 years ago after we had worked with the Thiel Foundation for about 5 years running the Thiel Fellowship and being on the founding team of that program. And it was through working with the, you know, actually I should give a little bit of background on the Thiel Fellowship. So the Thiel Fellowship is a grant program that was pretty controversial when we first launched in 2010. We started the application process for this new fellowship in 2011, when it was the first batch of Thiel Fellows. And the controversial piece about the Thiel Fellowship is that, you know, Peter and his colleagues had this idea of, hey, instead of young people maybe going into $100,000 in debt, going into college and, you know, be proclaimed an educated person, what if we gave people $100,000 to work on a project of their choosing over 2 years with the support of our program and support of mentorship? And it's been about, you know, it's been about 8 years since that program launched. And now I think the conversation about what it means to be an educated young person and what path to take, and should you go to college or should you not, is actually becoming more normalized, which is great. And that was the goal of the program, was to make that conversation something that was more regularly happening. But it was through running that program that my colleague Michael and I saw some really interesting investment opportunities coming out of it. We had a number of fellows who started companies that got good traction and were raising Series A rounds and beyond. And we thought, hey, we're running this program, but we could also start our own fund to work with people like Thiel Fellows and the wider younger entrepreneurial community, who is often overlooked by investors, and kind of go bigger, go home with our mission. So with 1517, we write a 250K check when someone is raising what's traditionally known in the Bay Area as a pre-seed round, usually raising $7 million. And we work predominantly with people who are non-degreed and who are on an alternative education path.
Interesting. Just one thing. It's a little noisy in the background. I don't know.
Sadly, there's construction going on right outside where I am. I will move somewhere else and see if that is helpful.
Okay.
Yeah, of all the days for construction, I was like, why does it have to be today?
we'll see if this is better. Well, wasn't it horrible? Just
yeah. Yeah, no, I get it.
Yeah.
It's always good to optimize.
Agreed.
All right. I have moved into a room that is quieter. So
oh,
let me
significantly
know,
better.
Let me know what you
yes,
think.
It is.
Okay, great.
Optimize exponentially.
Woohoo!
Cool. So the last thing you had said in terms of people that have either alternative backgrounds or a little bit different, essentially, how do you screen for that? Like, what are you looking for in the kinds of people that you're going to give money to?
Sure. I mean, there's a number of things we look for. One of the things that we like to talk about actually is building relationship with people over time. Mm-hmm. We're maybe atypical in the sense that we don't just have a pitch meeting with someone and sit down and then say, okay, we're going to go into diligence or not. you know, and make a decision within three meetings. We tend to know people over a period of months. And the way that we get to know people over months is not by saying, hey, you know, please wait for us for 6 months to invest in you while you're raising the rest of your round. No, it's more like we meet people when they are really, really early and what they're doing really nascent. Mm-hmm. We often meet people on college campuses, at hackathons, just through our contact form. We're very accessible and we'll help people out really early. So then what happens is, from like that mentoring perspective, we get to know people. And then when they come to us and say, hey, I think I'm ready to raise that sub-million-dollar round, here's what I'm working on, you know, we'll kind of know, like, does this person, you know, or the, does this team sort of pass our sniff test for what we're looking for? And there's a handful of those qualities that we like to really just examine over time. Some of that is, does this person have innate curiosity? Are they interested in different things? Do they like exploring topics? Are they not just sort of a one-trick pony, as it were?
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, one thing that we say that we like to look for is hyperfluency in our founders. And so people who can talk backwards and forwards about their area. There's something that we think is really important about founders who can communicate really well, because you're needing to onboard investors, you're needing to onboard hires, you're needing to do sales. Like, there's a really big communication piece of it. And so we look for that as well. We look for ability to execute. And so when we're working with people over time, what we're looking for is, do they set reasonable deliverables? Are they able to meet them or exceed them? If they're not able to meet them, are they able to reflect on that process and see, like, where they went, you know, sideways on something? You know, in addition, are they honest? Are they able to say, hey, here's what's not working? We definitely look for coachability as one of the things that we look for in people, because we, like, our job as investors is not just to put in financial capital, but to help these companies and grow them alongside them. And people who are not sort of willing to say, oh, hey, here's not what's not working, we can't help them as much. Or people who say, oh, no, like, everything's great all the time, that's also never true.
Right.
You know, so we look for sort of like that openness to be there. So those are, you know, we also look for technical ability. Like, you know, these people definitely need a blend of what I call core skills, which is like that communication and, you know, building a team. And oftentimes those skills are called soft skills, but I hate that they're called soft because I think they're all completely learnable. It's not just something you have or you don't.
Yeah.
But of course, then the technical skills are also really important. You know, we've seen teams who have tried to build things who don't have the ability to do it themselves, and they try to contract out the work, and it's just harder to do it that way. So we look at both. But those are some of the things that we look for with people. And in fact, actually, when we were first starting our fund, we went to a colleague of ours who used to be over at Founders Fund, and we were kind of looking for sage wisdom. We were like, hey, when we're making these investments at this pre-seed level, like, what should we be looking for? And are there certain sort of like equations we should be calculating?
Right.
And this guy just turned to us. He says, you guys, it's the Wild West. He's like, you have no idea at the pre-seed level. Like, it's so hard to understand what's going on. You know, everything's new. Maybe the R&D works, maybe it doesn't. Maybe the team blows up before anything even takes off. Like, he's like, it's just crazy out there. And I find that to actually be a very true statement. But that said, that's why we build relationship over time. So then we have all these data points on people. And so then when that team comes to us and says, hey, we're ready for funding, we have a pretty good sense right away of, like, is this a team we'd want to work with for the longer term or not?
Yeah. Now, are these people coming to you, or are you approaching them, a little bit of both? Like, how do you screen that out like that?
It's definitely both. You know, we've done a lot of community building over the last 8 years, from the Thiel Fellowship with other young entrepreneurial communities like Cairo Society, the Next Gen Summit, you know, our own founders. And so some people will have sort of a good spidey sense for, this person has some of the characteristics we're looking for, so we're going to keep in touch with this person over time. You know, maybe send a little email here and there. Hey, what's going on with you? Are you in town right now? Let's get coffee. Like, mm-hmm. You know, sometimes it feels my colleague calls it spycraft. He's like, you know, it's kind of like, not that we're like trying to like not spying in the nefarious sense, but
right. Sort
of spying in the sense of like, yeah, we're just trying to get information and find out, you know, who's working on what. you know, and if there's a chance that we can help people out with what they're doing. But yeah, it's also a lot of inbound. We have tons of people who come into our contact form. We get a lot of referrals from our own founders. I know one set of founders that we worked with, they were very savvy. They, you know, sort of collegially befriended a couple of the portfolio founders that we currently had. And then those people made referrals for them and said, hey, you really need to talk to these two people. They're really great. And I was like, wow, these guys did their homework on like how to get a great intro and, you know, just sort of show their prowess and things like that. But we also take cold emails from people and, you know, have built some really great relationships from people that didn't have like an in before. We really pride ourselves in being an accessible fund. It's one of our values. And so we answer, I would say, like, you know, 95 to 99% of the contact forms that come in, unless actually it's funny. I even had a team, you might appreciate this story, where one of the questions we ask on the contact form is like, tell us a fun fact about you or some sort of unique story. We love to get to know people. And these two young guys wrote in and everything was reading pretty smoothly. And then I got to that question and it was this jargon gobbledygook. Like, I was like, oh my God. I was like, I think these people might be certifiably crazy. Like, this paragraph doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And then we didn't respond to that one. I was like, okay, we're not touching this one. Like, because sometimes when you have the sense that someone is not quite right, they'll take a lot of your time and energy. And we're like, okay, we're not gonna respond to that one. But the two young men found my email address and they reached out to me and they said, hey, we hope you saw our contact form. We'd really love to be in touch. And I'm a really frank person. I come from an education background, and so I believe in giving feedback and being forthright. And so I wrote back to them and I said, guys, thanks for sending me this email. To be honest, your contact form was such a crazy mess there in the middle that I didn't want to respond because I wasn't sure if you were sane to be fully forthright with you. And they wrote back and they were like, oh my God, we're so sorry. We were trying to figure out what would stand out and what we would write. And so we just put something weird and it was late and da da da. And I met with them over breakfast and we talked about their work and what they're doing. And it turns out they're both really, really nice people and totally as sane as far as I can tell. But yeah, I really admired their sort of hustle and being like, okay, sent in a contact form, no response came, gonna reach out through email. And they were also really like humble in taking the feedback of like, hey, you know, you do want to stand out, but not for the wrong reasons.
It's almost like a little overcompensation thing sometimes.
Yeah, no, totally.
I've been in that position, so I can relate to it. So
cool. Very cool. Yeah, they were trying to stand out, and I totally get that. It just happened to be that they were standing out for all the wrong reasons.
Right. I would imagine, too, that you probably get the wrong kinds of people reaching out to sometimes. Like, can you talk about what, like, you don't – like, if we want to, you know, invert this a little bit, what would what do you not look for in someone? That's always interesting.
Mm. You know, one thing that we talk about is one of the things we look for, and we didn't talk about this, so I'm glad you asked this question, is we look for mission-drivenness in our founders. You know, like there's this term of like, would you be willing to die in your sword for something? And when we're talking with people about like, hey, like, why are you starting this company? Why are you the team to do it? Like, what's going to make you in this for the long haul for 10 years? When someone doesn't have like a guttural, passionate attachment to what they're doing, entrepreneurship is really, really hard. You know, the failure rate is really, really high. And so if you're doing it because you're like, oh, there's a business model here, we can exploit this market, things like that, you know, people who sort of enjoy the label serial entrepreneur, that kind of thing can rub us sort of the wrong way.
Yeah.
You know, not all serial entrepreneurs are the same. I'm sure there are many who have done very mission-driven, die-on-your-sword sort of startups, but then there are people who just like to do the quick flip and things like that. And that's one thing we look at too, is that, you know, if a person's in it for sort of a quick business flip, like, oh, we'll sell, you know, to a larger company within a couple of years, that's also not the type of return that a venture fund looks at as favorable, because what we need to do is have one or two of our companies be such a huge success that it negates the learning experiences that all of our other companies have, whether they, you know, peter out, whether they
you know, have some success, but not the type of success that can return a fund and so on. So when we're seeing people who have that like quick flip mentality, that's not something that is from a economics perspective is going to really be helpful for our fund.
You know, what's so interesting talking to you, and it's like, as you're talking, I'm like, oh, you need to talk to this person. You need to like, you almost remind me of, you know, cause my background in value investing, like the people that I either, you know, like to learn about or even associate with, you know, like I was watching a Google talk yesterday from the CEO of Brookfield Asset Management, Bruce Flatt, right? Mm-hmm. And are you familiar with his company?
I don't think so.
So, you know, I think it might be like the second largest real estate company in the world now or something like it's mm-hmm. top five. I think it's number two, right? Everyone knows BlackRock, you know, like that, just everyone knows mm-hmm. that.
Of course.
But it's just like, you know, even though he's doing something completely different than you, you know, he's running a business, you know, where they're investing in real assets. So, you know, real estate, infrastructure projects, pipelines, stuff like that, right? But the way he talks about things, right, it's so different than your typical BlackRock of, you know, oh, we have this cap rate and we're going to invest in, you know, put it in and then we can sell it a few years later and blah, blah, blah. You know, this is a company where he's looking to buy assets, ideally for holding them forever. You know, he's looking for really interesting opportunities to work with interesting people. He always talks about the people around him. He has an open office space. Like there's another guy, Tom Gaynor from Markel Corporation, and you just listen to him and, you know, here's a guy running an insurance company, but it's all about who he's partnering with. And when I went to their annual meeting 2 years ago, I was talking to one of the IT people at the organization, and I said, oh, it was like, how long have you been working at Markel Corporation for? He goes, oh, I've been here 6 months. And I go, oh, you know, you're pretty new. He goes, well, you know, I was working at a company called Altera, and then Markel bought us out. And, you know, so now I'm at Markel. I go, oh, was that a tough transition to, you know, switch from one IT department to the other? He goes, actually, no, it was really easy because, you know, even though – so Markel has a thing called the Markel style, which is like sort of defines their principles and values. Mm. But it's not some bullshit thing because every company has that mission statement. But it's really embedded in the culture. And he's like, you know, even though Altera didn't have the Altera style equivalent, we were already doing the Markel style. We just didn't have words for it. So when they purchased us, you know, besides the price, they needed a culture that already – align with us. So it was actually really, it's really easy. It feels like I'm working with the same kinds of people. And like, you don't hear that, especially from an IT person talking about the culture.
Right. Yeah. That's a really fair point.
Yeah. So I always find it fascinating when I can talk to someone who has these principles, but then is in a completely different, you know, field of investing. So it's like you're doing, would it be fair to say you're an angel investor? Would that be the proper word?
So angel investors, no, angel investors work on their own primarily. So we are a pre-seed fund. Yeah. So like usually an angel, I mean, some angels can write 250 paychecks, sure. But the majority of angels are usually between like 10 and 50, sometimes 100. So we're a little bit up the stack from the angels, but we have an angel mentality that it's about relationships.
Right. That's why I said that.
Yeah, and it's one of these things too, where especially like when giving feedback and things like that, we really believe that it's not just what a company looks like right this second; it's about what it could look like. And mm-hmm. you know, we're, like I said earlier, we're very frank in giving feedback, and like we've told people, you know, when we're in diligence, hey, here's like what we're really enjoying about going through the diligence process with you, and here's what we're not enjoying, and here's where we think we need to shore up like some expertise or. You know, run the process a little differently or things like that. And mm-hmm. we've had companies where we've said, hey, listen, like, we love the team. Like, this seems interesting, but we can't quite get the conviction to write a check yet. Like, you know, we have limited partners in our fund. So it's, you know, Michael and I come from the nonprofit world. We have, you know, we do not yet have the capability to write checks all by ourselves. Mm-hmm. So every time, you know, we're making a bet on a company, we're using someone else's money to do that. So we take that extremely responsibly. And we'll say, like, you know, we have not been able to get to a point of conviction yet with what you're doing. You know, we'd like to see you know, these three bullet points kind of shored up. Like, we'd like to see you in a pilot with somebody validating out this assumption some more. Usually a lot of what we talk about is validating assumptions, because people come in with all kinds of great ideas and intuitions about things. We're like, this is an awesome idea, it's an awesome intuition, but you got to go test it in the market.
Right.
And we've had companies that will come back to us 3 months later and say, hey, I think I have all those proof points that you all need. And we'll look and we'll say, wow, this is fantastic. Let's come in now and work together. And so we keep that line of communication open, where I think a lot of funds will say things like, oh, just keep in touch, keep me informed, and they'll never give you a firm yes or no, and they'll never give you actual feedback on what they're looking for. And so people have thanked us profusely about how transparent we are about things. And even when we tell people like a no of some form, or like, here's the proof points that would get us to yes, or right now we're no because of these things, we always caveat too with humility and say, you know what, our job is also to be wrong a lot.
Right.
Like, and we can't know what's going to happen in the future with a market. We can't know what's going to happen with the technology. And so we really hope you are right and that your company does fabulously. We just can't get the conviction to get there yet. And people are like, wow, that's like amazing to hear that, instead of just like this weird, shady, who knows what it means language.
Interesting. Now, are you also helping these entrepreneurs with, you know, ways they could structure their company? Like, are you giving them business feedback? Like, let's say they have, you know, they have an intuition. They know it works in the marketplace, but like, you know, we don't necessarily know how we want, you know, maybe what marketplace, or maybe the structure and how we implement it. You know, do you give feedback?
Yeah, we give feedback in all areas. And I think, you know, the thing that sometimes when people are asking really specific questions, the best thing we can do is connect them to people who will have a better hunch or intuition or specific knowledge and skill set than us in an area. One way that I describe our work is like 1517 is like Grand Central Station. You're not supposed to hang out there. You're supposed to get on a train and go somewhere else. And so sometimes it's that advice from us. And I think we are, you know, pretty good at helping our founders kind of think through things. You know, myself with a teaching background and my co-founder, who's a philosopher, we like to use the Socratic method a lot with our founders and talking with them and being like, well, what do you think about this? Like, you have the most knowledge of any of us in this room on this topic. Like, what do you think needs to be the next step? And we'll also ask, like, have you thought about this? Have you thought about this? You know, we'll talk too about how sometimes the best mentors for your company are people who have come a year before you. It's not necessarily someone who's 20 years of experience in the industry, though that can certainly be a mentor as well. But sometimes it's the person who just raised a round who's 6 months to a year ahead of you and really knows what it's like to be out there in the market. And so we'll say, hey, listen, you're at 1517 Grand Central right now. You need to get on this train and talk to this person who just did this 6 months ago, because they're going to have some real insight for you. And they're like, great, let's do that. So it's all about these connections and conversations that happen and putting the right people in the right place at the right time.
Interesting. And how do you look at, you know, so it's very clear what you look for in people that you're going to be investing in, or groups, you know, groups of people to invest in. Do you have certain ways of screening for investors or limited partners? You know, because I would imagine they're going to have to be aligned with what you're doing. Because you don't want people pulling money out at the worst time.
No, it's true. It's true. And you want your limited partners to be as passionate as you are about what you're doing, to really be a partner and not just quiet capital.
Exactly.
You know, one of the questions that we have on our diligence checklist with our potential portfolio companies is which of our LPs would be most suited to look at this deal alongside of us because of some of their expertise or what they bring to the table, or maybe they like doing direct investments. In fact, earlier today, we talked to a company that's in Mexico City. Is in Mexico City, and one of our investors is in Latin America. And so we said, hey, like, you might want to talk to this investor of ours, because he knows that market way more than we do and can give you insight, and they're going to talk, and that'll be great. So we do look for value-added investors on our side, because they add value to our portfolio companies as well. Mm-hmm. So that's really important. You know, conviction is really important to us. We're actually raising our second fund right now, and sometimes you get these lines from people that they'll say things like, oh, well, I always come in at last close. And I'm like, last close, like, that means you come in when there's no more diligence to do,
no conviction, because it's like everybody up front has taken the initial risk.
Right.
And what I don't like about that is that, especially for people who also say, oh, we want to do co-investments together, I don't want to introduce my companies to another potential investor who's going to string them along for a long time and then write a check at the end, or maybe not write a check at all. I like people who are willing to step up to the plate, take a swing at the bat, you know, show some conviction, be interested in risk, and go from there, because that's what it takes to invest also in the startup community. And a lot of our LPs are also direct investors in startups.
And how do you look at risk exactly? I mean, you know, like when you're investing in people, I mean, you're obviously going to say, okay, these people are going to make mistakes along the way.
Yeah.
I mean, do you expect that you're going to have lower rates of like, you know, in terms of permanent failure of, you know, companies going to zero, or, you know, what do you typically expect?
So, I don't know if that's the right question to ask, but. Yeah, no, it's a great question to ask. And so, you know, there's some different theories about venture capital and how it works, but the theory that we have largely been steeped in is what we learned from Peter Thiel, and that's that it's a power law distribution. And that basically means that, not that, you know, like some people might say, oh, like you want to pick on like people who are middle of the road, and, you know, if you pick enough of them, then enough of them will return your fund, but at a smaller level each. But that's not what we do. What we say is, like, the power law distribution is, you know, you're going to make 20 bets, and one of them is going to hit so hard on their home runs that it's going to be the company, you know, that that returns the whole fund and financially, you know, makes things, basically, which is a scary position to be in. And I do say, and I'm quite candid with people, that, you know, venture, I think, is I was talking to who's a CTO the other day at a company, and he's an engineer, and he said, you know, I'm really fascinated by the work you do because it's a really different mindset that I have. He says, as an engineer, I'm always looking at where the problems are, and I'm kind of like pessimistic. I'm like, will this work? Am I constantly checking things? And there's constant feedback loops. And he's like, in your world, it seems like you have to be kind of like eternally optimistic. The feedback loops are really long. Like, you're not going to know for like a year or 2 years, kind of like, are those companies going to get the markups? What's going to happen? Things like that. Like, it's a totally different way of thinking about things. And I agreed with him. I was like, yeah, it is true. And you know, sometimes in a funny moment, I'll tell people, I think, you know, us general partners are all delusional, because we have to believe that every single one of our portfolio companies that we invest in could be the one that is the power law company,
right?
That is the one that does the best. And that's crazy thinking. Like, we have 46 companies in our portfolio, and we really have to think, like, pretty much each and every one of these could be the one. And that would be amazing if it ever became true, but that's like myth and lore and fairy tale. Like, that's not reality. And so, you know, we do think about the risk in the portfolio and how do we balance things out. We're a generalist fund, so we're in everything from software and apps to a material science company and a biotech company. And so we try to balance these things out. We like doing deep tech, but we also know that deep tech takes, you know, longer to kind of, from like a financial perspective, like show markups and show returns and things like that. And so, you know, we're also in like a lot of B2B SaaS plays and things like that, where it's a little easier to find product market fit and know if that's there. And, you know, scale is very difficult and hard.
When you say you're a generalist fund, do you mean generalist tech or generalist?
What I mean is, like, I guess what I'm trying to say is that we're agnostic to the type of technology. Like, some funds are like, oh, we only do med tech, or we only do this type or that type, or we're a hardware fund, or we're a software fund. We do a little of everything.
As long as it's in the technological.
It does have to be in the technological end, because those things have the most potential for scale, which gets into that power law distribution theory again. So we meet with a lot of people who have some really great business ideas, but we can't get behind that it would be a venture scalable idea. And I don't believe that all companies should be venture scalable. I actually think that there's something quite toxic, to be honest, about sort of the startup community being about like building a unicorn, you know, and like these outsized returns all the time, because you can have a perfectly wonderful business and a great life, and it not be anywhere close to that. Like, my first business was a tutoring company out of college, and it was great. Like, and it was fine, and it led to where I am today, and I wouldn't have known that at the time. But I don't think everything has to be like a gargantuan company. And so people often come and talk to me, and there's a company that I've really loved working with that actually works a little bit in, like, I'd call it like home agriculture. They make grow kits, and you can like sprout your own seeds at home. And I have one at home, and I love it, and I use it all the time. And they pitched me on it. I was like, gosh, I was like, I really love you two. You're awesome. And I love the product. I was like, but I'm really having a hard time wrapping my head around how this becomes like in our economics, you know, what we're looking at are companies that could be worth more than $400 million.
Right.
And that's the tough part.
So is that one of your criteria that you could reasonably see it being worth $400 million at some point in the future?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
That is correct. But on the other hand, like, I've loved working with this team, and you know, I use their product, like, I offer them feedback and advice, and I'm really open to, like, you know what, like, I want them to prove me wrong. I want them to come back at some point and be like, hey, listen, like, our market's growing in this direction. We found this new thing that people want in their homes. Like, you know, I always love to get the learnings from founders and like the counterintuitive information and things like that. But it's interesting because, like, I don't think every company inherently is not meant to be a scalable venture business.
Absolutely,
but that doesn't mean it's a bad thing. But we definitely have sort of a toxic culture around, like, if you're not like trying to build a unicorn, then you're not doing enough. And I just think that's a terrible attitude.
I guess it depends on what community you're part of. I mean, you see this on Wall Street, right, where you have companies that you could say there's a toxicity on Wall Street that values, growth, that, you know, we need more revenue growth. But basic, if you know, it's like with just a simple understanding of basic business economics, if you have a company with low returns on capital, you're going to be the more you grow, the more you're actually destroying value.
Right.
Where then you have the opposite, where say a company like a Facebook or a Google that takes almost no capital, right? So the returns on capital are incredible. Right. So the more revenue growth, the better the business, right? So growth in and of itself doesn't really mean shit if you don't understand what it takes to make that growth.
Right. Yep, exactly.
What would you say is the biggest maybe mistake that you've made or a few mistakes that you've made that have been influential for you that you've learned from while doing this?
Yeah, let me think. Like, so many things. I guess one of the things that has come to mind is that, you know, we took a decision theory making course when we were first starting the fund, in particular because one of our LPs has been in the field of decision making and probably is very instrumental in shaping it since the 70s. And so he was running one of his courses. It's just like a over the phone kind of course and a few weeks long. And it was all about how do you know if you've made a good decision? How do you think about decision making after you've made the decision? And because especially in venture, there's something where you make your decision, yay or nay, and then you keep getting more information over time. So sometimes you're like, oh man, you know, this company, we missed out. Like, how'd we miss out on this great thing? Or you invest in something and like things start going poorly and you sort of start wondering, oh, how, you know, what could I have done differently to make that decision? But we did this decision making course and we came up with our due diligence checklist after we went through that course. And the things that I most often see for us from a mistake perspective is that when we get overconfident and we don't go through every single step of our diligence process, it'll be like, oh man, we should have talked, you know, we should have done the cold outreach that we sometimes do. Like, sometimes we'll do cold outreach on LinkedIn and be like, hey, like, we're just looking for a cold reference on someone, you know, instead of the references they give you. Or, you know, we should have talked to an extra customer or something like that. And so sometimes I think it can be easy to maybe feel overwhelmed, like there's a lot of work to do, and just be like, oh, well, you know, this is all really checking out. This is all great. And then be like, oh, we skipped like one part of our process and that
that has been the thing, you know, that hasn't gone well. Uh-huh. But on that feedback side, because we are proactive with our founders, something that we learned over time was just like the importance of giving more raw feedback. Like, I think sometimes in the beginning we try to couch things a little bit, make it a little bit nice. And sometimes, you know, like we had one founder who basically only communicated with us when they wanted money, but never any other times. And
that's not a good sign.
There were always excuses. Yeah, there were always excuses. Oh, things are so busy, this is this. But everything's golden. And we're like, I don't know about that. And then it was like, oh, yeah. But, you know, we'd love to catch up. We're raising more money. We're doing this. You know, so we've learned a lot about sort of like the personality profiles and giving that hard feedback. You know, we've learned a lot about working with our own investors, with our LPs. I think something I didn't know when we first started the fund was how much of our work would be just courting our LP base, making sure they're informed and connected, getting access to deals, you know, just checking in with them. I mean, one of our LPs just had his first son, and you know, he's got this little baby at home, and just checking in, being like, hey, how's it going over there? Like, you know, so it's, there's so much relationship drivenness that it can be a lot to juggle, and just making sure you're like on top of a lot of stuff. I think those are some of the big learnings. I guess the other, I'm trying to think, like one learning that we've had both for ourselves between me and Michael on our team, mm-hmm. Plus watching other teams, is that, you know, when stress and pressure like comes, teams can do a couple of things, and probably more than a couple of things, but I've sort of narrowed it down to two things. They can point their energy at like solving the external problem that has arisen of like, gosh, we're having a hard time getting a second meeting, or we're having a hard time with this technology or whatever it is, or they can point the energy at each other and start fighting. And we've learned a lot about that of like, you know, like, we have a talk that we give all about what we've learned over the past 3 years. And one of them is that like fighting can start out really cute. Like me and Michael, for example, have sort of different like email styles and, different prioritization of certain tasks and things like that. And, you know, even things like calendaring or, one funny thing that Michael and I always joke about is he will often use the same subject lines for things. And so then in my inbox, it's like all stacked up under one thing. And I'm like, no, you have to make a new subject line. You can't keep using the same one. But that's all really cute when things aren't problematic. But then when like stress and pressure comes, all that other stuff also gets 10x'd. And so you need to be able to keep an objective mind of like, okay, what is going on between our team right now, and how can we focus our energies on like solving the problems that we're externally facing? Like, how can we, you know, sort of, you know, stave off whatever hardships we're having instead of turning that energy inward towards each other and just having like an internal battle of like this and that, and you're driving me crazy and blah, blah, blah. And we've seen this with our teams a lot too, where when the going gets tough, some people can really like band together and fight the problem, or they band against each other and fight each other. And so that's been actually a really big learning for us in the last year, I would say, for certain teams. And we've been able to give that feedback to teams too. Like we have one team who's having a hard time right now. And I said one thing that's really nice about what you all are going through right now is that you're not fighting each other, you're fighting the problem, and we've seen it go the other way. And they were like, wow, thanks for telling us that, because we don't even know that that's an option. And I was like, yeah, it is an option. You could be like pointing fingers and saying, well, we wouldn't be in this position if you didn't do this and blah, 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 and you're not doing that. And that tells me that you as a team and as friends are going to make it through this no matter what the outcome is.
That's interesting. Have you found that, you know, I could see some people, I could just picture some listeners right now hearing, oh, this sounds really nice and really great, and it's great that you build all these personal relationships. Has it transferred over into economic gain, which, you know, for your LP investors is also what they care about?
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah. I mean, so one of our so we have 46 portfolio companies.
We probably have some issues if it didn't, right?
Yeah, that's right. We fund people when they tend to be a team of like 2 or 4 people. It's just a little sprout of an idea. You know, there's no real IP potentially yet because it's just really nascent. Mm-hmm. And we have a handful of companies now that are at the Series A level, some that are starting to raise Series B. So that means those companies have gone from being two or four people to like 35 people. We actually visited one of our companies yesterday and they had moved into a new office space. And I'm always dumbstruck when my companies move into a new office space because there's something about inhabiting your own domain, instead of just some little office somewhere or co-working space where I'm like, whoa, you're like a real company now. You have 35 people here and like your name's on the door and there's a doorman downstairs who like knows who you are. That is very interesting. And so it's a big change from where things are. And so yeah, we have our companies gaining traction that way. We have one company, our outlier company right now is Luminar Technologies. That company was in part started by Austin Russell, who we met actually before the Thiel Fellowship. We met him when he was in high school, and we got to know him, and we got to know his whole family, actually. Like, we're quite chatty with his mom in particular. And he was 17 at the time, and we brought him into the finalist round for the fellowship, and then we brought him into the fellowship. And he had this idea where he wanted to basically like work out on some physics problems for a couple of years. And we didn't know if Austin was crazy or crazy awesome. Yeah. We couldn't really tell. We were like, this guy is really sharp and really bright, but also seems to be telling us that like he could potentially do things that other people have not done before. And that's either like that's grandiose or magical thinking. Or maybe he's onto something here. And he started working with LiDAR sensors. And at first he was going to build this sensor to actually work in the film industry, doing like special effects and green screen capabilities and things like that using LiDAR. But it was around the same time actually when the autonomous sort of driving bug, if you will, was starting to take off. And so he moved into that direction, and he built a team of five people and started building that away. Fast forward this story. When we first met with their team of five people, they were working in a garage in Orange County, really scrappy. The tech was more bulky, things like this. And now it's been 3 more years. The company's about 5 or 6 years old at this point. They have 400 employees total split between Orlando and Palo Alto, and it just blows my mind to go. And whenever we visit and do a review with the company, we met with their CFO, their new CFO that they have, who I used to be the CFO of Fitbit. And, I'm sitting there talking to a man who has 20 years of experience doing this, and it's like, wow, they've garnered some amazing talent. They have 400 employees now. They have public partnerships with Toyota and Volvo. And they've had tons of press over the last couple of months. And, we're keeping our fingers crossed that they're going to become the dominating player in the autonomous driving space for building these sensors. But it's been truly incredible to see. Now, on a returns perspective, mm-hmm. I think you had mentioned someone earlier where you were saying they sort of batten down the hatches and it's a long-term game for them. And yep. It's the same for us. So it's not something where we say, oh yeah, great. 1517 has been running for 3 years. We'll sell off some of our private shares to other people. No, we're in this for the long haul. And so on a economics math perspective, we have company markups that we calculate, but markups change. Like, you see companies that go from being worth quite a bit of money to worth zero. Sure. And so, there are all these sort of things we're going to have to do thinking forward, especially with our companies that are doing well, of, hey, like, how long do we hold on to the equity that we've accrued here? Do we sell any of it in the private market? Do we, do we go the long, long haul? And our gut intuition is to go the long haul, but of course, we're working with our investors, and so we'll be soliciting information from them too over time of, hey, look, like, these companies are taking off, like, what sort of liquidity do you want right now? And talking about that as well.
It makes me think, when you just brought that up, there's a general rule of thumb. I don't know if it applies to what you're doing, but my gut says it would, so you can tell me if my gut's wrong here. Mm-hmm. is generally in, you know, an equity investing or really any kind of investing, the greatest returns are where there's the least amount of capital, right? You know, there's least amount of capital doesn't mean inherently there's gonna be great returns. Like, you know, if you're gonna invest in typewriters, it doesn't inherently mean it's a great return. But and one of the places where there tends to be less capital is places where you need and really are required to have long-term thinking. It's funny, right? It's like everyone says, oh, I'm not a gambler, I'm an investor, I have a long-term mindset, right? Yet, if you look at what they're doing, they're still trading in and out of things, or they're selling at the worst possible times. And it's always easy to say you have a long-term mindset when things are good.
Of course. Right? It's true.
Right? And it's always interesting when things are bad, how much harder it is to get capital when that's probably the best time to be invested.
It's true.
And right. So I look at companies, Berkshire Hathaway and Warren Buffett, right? You know, where he says we don't think in days or months, we're thinking in decades, right? You know, I mentioned Brookfield before. You know, when they're buying a piece of property, they're thinking over the next 30, 40, 50 years, not, what the price is going to be next year.
Yeah.
Do you find that there's a competitive advantage for you guys that you can really walk your talk of having a significantly longer time horizon than maybe your average VC fund or whatever?
Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing I can say is that we learned a lot in those first 5 years at the Teal Foundation about being patient, because it was quite a ride to jump on board with a bunch of 17, actually even a 16-year-old through like 19 or 20-year-olds who were getting started on things, and sort of the whole world was watching, like, what's going to happen? What's going to pan out here? And there were days when the roller coaster was on low point, and we were like, wow, it seems like everybody and their brother is just doing fantastically awful right now. Like, this is really, really hard. Like, you know, can we justify running this program anymore? Like, should we do another one next year? Like, it brought up a lot of existential kind of questions. And then there were other days where it was like, wow, things are really taking off. Like, this company's doing well. This fellow launched this. This one got some awesome press on a thing. Like, and so we learned a lot about that up and down swing a lot within investing. And it's something that we keep in mind just constantly with what we're doing. But we also think about it from a portfolio balance perspective. Like, I would be more nervous, I think, if our fund were only funding really deep technology plays. Just because, you know,
what do you mean by a deep technology play? What is that?
Deep technology meaning like really heavy R&D.
Okay.
You know, like our material science company, you know, our companies that are in biotech or even med tech and things like that. There's like higher barriers to entry. There's technical risk. There's regulatory risk, things like this. I think if we were invested 100% on that side, one thing that I know now after being, you know, with my fund for 3 years is that, you know, when we're talking to our investors, they want to see, like, how is the portfolio doing? Like, what are the markups? Like, where are things going? And so I think it is helpful to have a balance between things that can have that movement that people can kind of, on a more reasonable timeline, start holding on to versus the things where it's like, hey, yep, like, we're incubating, you know, we're sitting on these sprouts or eggs or whatever you want to call it. And, like, it's going to take a lot of time for these ones to come forward. But another thing we know, too, is that, like, you know, from a capital perspective, most fundraising rounds are really only meant to fund something, you know, at least at the earlier stages, for 8 months to 18 months or so. And so we also want to think about, is this company capitalized enough to be able to make it to the proof points that they're going to need for that next round that they have, rather than petering out and not hitting those milestones and then saying, gosh, like, we just burned $1 million in capital because we didn't know what was, you know, normal expectations for raising the second round of funding. And that's where we come in to kind of help our companies to think about what do they need to think about to raise that next round of capital, and what are those proof points that they need to get to. And we need to think about the same thing with our fund, because we do need to show traction within our companies, but it's also nice to show
you know, we're not just in the easy stuff. Like, we're in some of the hard stuff too.
Huh. Interesting.
How do you align incentives between LP money, what you get compensated for, and then the, you know, equity stakes that you take in your founders?
Sure. Yeah, so the ways, like, we are pretty standard in what we do in those arenas. There's a typical sort of equation called 2 and 20. And that means of the capital we raise from investors, we can use 2% of it to manage the fund. And that goes towards salaries, that goes towards office space, that goes towards flying to C portfolio companies, like all the like nitty gritty, you know, phone plans, like all that stuff. So we have that to sort of run and operate the business.
Mm-hmm.
And then the 20% means that
the performance, you know, fee.
The performance, exactly. So once we return the capital of the fund, then any additional returns, 80% goes to our LPs, and then 20%, you know, goes to the general partners. And so that's how that aspect works out.
And what kind of returns? I mean, it's always probably hard to have some kind of expected return in what you're doing. But is there a general range where you say this is kind of ideally what we like to hit in terms of our hurdle?
I mean, generally, like, you know, like the best venture capital funds, like 3x their fund.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if we have a $20 million fund, you know, then we'd like to bring in, you know, $60 million in capital back. But we'll see. I mean, it's our first fund. We'll see where we end up hitting things in the long term, you know, and go from there. But yeah, it's a big thing to think about, being like, whoa, okay. Like, that means we have to have some pretty extraordinary companies come through our pipeline, and we need to make sure we're servicing them properly and picking them properly and so on. And then on the side of working with companies, when we write that 250 paycheck, we like to come in for about 5% of equity. That's just sort of a target number for us to try to reach that, you know, if this company, you know, is worth $400 million, like, what percentage would we need to be able to return our fund? That's about 5%, and so that's what we go for. And you know, like, the feedback we've gotten from people is that it's pretty reasonable. I still remember a young man I met at a hack, and he's like, comes up to the table, he's like, I'm trying to just figure out, you know, like, your business model and how much do you take. And I was like, yeah, for a 250K check, we asked for 5%, and his jaw hit the floor. And I said, I honestly don't know if your look on your face is like a good look or a bad look. I'm like, why don't you tell me what you're thinking?
Yeah.
And he's like, that's amazing. He's like, I talked to, you know, this fund that's on my campus, and they were going to take, you know, 5% for $20,000 or something like that. And I was like, oh, okay. Now I understand why you're making that face. But you know, as founders need to think about, you know, what's the value of the capital that's coming on board? You know, is this smart money that's coming in? Is it quiet money? You know, there's the term dumb money as well. Dumb money, I think should just be called like annoying money. You have an investor who's just pestering you all the time, and you're like, gosh, you're not helping me. You're like taking time and energy away from my company.
Have the wrong psychological incentives in the first place.
Right. They might not have like the grit to be able to wait, you know, the years that it's going to take for things to really take off. That doesn't mean that, you know, quiet money is, you know, it's just what it sounds like. It's quiet. So you do want people to check in with you and being helpful, but you don't want people who are, you know, texting you weird things all the time.
Do you have some kind of lockup period that you have people agree to?
I'm trying to remember in our docs, like, what we have there. I mean, the way we think about it is that, you know, when we make that investment, like, it's final. Like, we're no, you know, I don't know. We don't say to people like, oh, hey, we need that funding back or anything like that. Like, well, we very much think about it as like, you know, we're making an informed decision, and sometimes we're going to make a decision that pans out great. Sometimes we're going to make decisions that don't pan out great, but the responsibility is on us for that.
Sure.
You know, that's like, yeah, we own that. We don't say to our founders like, well, you should have done this and you should have done that. And blah, blah. It's like, no, that responsibility comes down, you know, to me and Michael.
Yeah. Interesting. Where do you you know, over the next 5 years, where do you guys see yourself going with things?
Well, just, you know, I think I used the phrase go big or go home with you earlier. And yep. So, you know, we want to keep doing this for the foreseeable future and working with younger founders and keep proving out that, you know, one path is not for all on that educational mission piece that we have. And we love making investments in companies that can make a dent in the universe. And so, you know, one of the questions we always ask ourselves on our diligence checklist is, would we be proud to have this company on our website? Do we think that, you know, this is something that the world needs? And so I'm also excited technologically to see some things come into existence, you know, that haven't been before. And in addition, also excited to make a dent in the investing universe, because we do things fairly differently than other investors do. And I would love for our if character is the right word, or just behaviors, I guess, of just like how we do things, to be more common within the venture community. Like, we hear from founders all the time these harrowing tales of, oh, I had this meeting and it was terrible and here's why. And I'm actually going to be working on a blog post all about like terrible investor behavior, but I gotta sit down and actually write a draft of that first.
Well, you know, regardless if it becomes more mainstream or not, I mean, if the model proves out, I hate using the word model. If this ethos proves out and works out, I would imagine, you know, you'll end up having
people follow because of that.
Well, no, actually, no, it's not what I was going to say. I actually am not convinced people will follow because of that, but I can see more founders, that the kind of people you're wanting to attract are going to come to you because they know you, they kind of have the right home. And I make the comparison to Berkshire Hathaway, where, you know, what Buffett and Munger were doing at the beginning was very unconventional and very different for, you know, we're buying businesses. We don't really ever sell them for the most part. Mm. You know, we like management that's already in place, good people, all that, right? And at first it comes off as a little counterintuitive. Like, why would, you know, I've actually had business owners who didn't really know much about Buffett be like, why would someone who runs a business sell and then stay with the business? Like I've had people say that to me before. And you look over 50 plus years now and you have these great, wonderful companies selling to Berkshire with the knowingness that they sold to a hedge fund, they get a significantly higher premium for their business.
Yep.
But they choose to sell to Berkshire because they know it's a good home for the company.
Yeah.
And I could see that
and
happening.
Reputation matters. Yeah. Reputation matters a lot. Like, I think we get a lot of our deals because of our reputation. And we've also, you know, sometimes like on the economics front, it's paid off where people have wanted to work with us so much that they're kind of willing to, they're willing to let us in when like a round is like already complete and we're just starting a conversation with them, or, you know, things like this where it's like, oh, like our reputation really does precede us and people know that, you know, working with us is going to be helpful to them and we're not going to jerk people around and they are going to have a very different experience than most funds that they go into. And so people are willing to work with us in all kinds of like different ways just because of that and because they know.
Yeah, and the reason I was saying earlier that I'm not sure either way whether people would follow in terms of starting similar things is, you know, you look at other sort of, to me, what are almost common sense principles, right? Like, you know, have a long-term thinking, you know, in equity investing, you know, buy things that are undervalued. Yet the vast majority of people on Wall Street are not value people. They don't have long-term thinking. You look at, you know, whether it's in the insurance industry that has screwed up incentives where you have underwriters that are incentivized to write policies versus write profitable policies. In the shipping industry, you want to talk about a fucked up industry. You have people who will when shipping rates are high, these companies will take on massive amounts of debt to build ships. It takes like, you know, quite a while to build a ship, and sometimes by the time the ship's built, the shipping rates have declined by like 90 to 99% literally like sometimes mm-hmm. that steep, and then these companies go under, and you'd think to yourself like, these lessons should have been learned by now, and they don't get learned. So right. I don't know. I hope you're right. I hope that more people do this, because I've personally, and I'd actually like to hear your take on this, but like I watch a show like Shark Tank, right?
Yeah.
Which is very entertaining, and mm-hmm. what blows my mind is that some people invest like that. Like, these people don't know who they're talking to. They have some mm-hmm. very fancy pitch, and I guess like in you know like what's his name Mark Cuban, people like this, like they're not dumb sure. people, right? Like they've done very yeah. well. But what's yeah. and actually I've always wanted to ask some of this, so I'm honored that you get to be the person I ask this to.
Like, okay.
What's always just doesn't ever sit right with me is like, here you are giving people capital and you're like critiquing them on how like nice their pitch is. And I just mm-hmm. and I think to myself, like, if I'm looking at a company to invest in and their report is like super glossy and like mm-hmm. all this jargon, like I'm actually more turned off by that.
Oh, totally.
Right? And like, yeah, totally. There's nothing like inherently bad about that, but I'm thinking like, you know, if your thing is so great, why do you need to, like, you know, make your words rhyme and, like, give me a little poetry right. thing? Like, that doesn't make yeah. sense. What does it have mm-hmm. to do with being a good investor? Unless, right. you know, mm-hmm. unless I was hiring you for, like, a marketing thing where I'm like, hey, I need a good jingle for my company. Who's best right. at marketing? Then that matters to me. Yeah. So I just don't get it. Can you explain
yeah.
to me why that's yeah, so
unbiased? Yeah, I mean, I think maybe I can talk a little to the point of the full transparency. I've only watched Shark Tank once.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, I've gone to tons of pitch competitions, and I don't like the pitch competition model of like you stand up, whoever does the best pitch sort of wins, because right. to me it's never about the pitch. It's about like the underlying technology. It's about the team. It's about these things that you glean some of in the pitch, but you can't glean the whole thing. Right. You know, one thing that I do like about TV and shows and stuff in general is it can bring some awareness to a culture about something that they might not know very much about. It's like, I remember when like the World Series of Poker took off and people were like watching poker all the time and like thinking about betting. And it's like, oh, that like sort of came into group consciousness as a thing. I kind of feel like something like Shark Tank does the same thing for investing in startups and things like that. It doesn't necessarily show it the way that I would want it to be, because that's not the way that I think of investing or how I would.
But it brings it into the social consciousness.
But it brings it into the social consciousness of the group and the awareness. So I do like that aspect. But on the like, yeah, this person has a flashy pitch. I mean, one person that I met with, this is a couple of years ago, who's an investor in LA, he said it's actually really hard to evaluate things here in LA because you have people who are pitching you who are also like, who are trying to break into acting or are actors and things like that. And they're really good at pitching. They're like super smooth and they can say all the right things and they present well and they look nice. And
it would scare me.
it looks really good. But then like you look under the hood and you're like, and one of the questions we always ask people, usually like 15 minutes into a meeting, is one of my questions is like, so what actually exists right now? Like, I want to know, show me, pop the hood open. I want to see, is there an engine in there? Or is there like the machinations of an engine? Or is it just like smoke and mirrors? And,
right.
And then we get to the nitty gritty, and that's what I get really interested in. So I do wish some of these shows would show sort of some of that nitty gritty. I don't know how much these shows like follow up with some of the teams, but like, where are they now? That would be a really cool thing to do. But yeah, it's something where I appreciate that there's like a social consciousness around entrepreneurship and investing and things like that. You know, is it like, I don't know that like TV is ever really like the truth of how something looks. But I enjoy that it's publicly out there.
You don't think the Brady Bunch is realistic?
Seriously, right? If they can dance, we all just get a coach and can all dance fabulous. Like,
exactly, right? Interesting. You know, is there anything else that you think that I haven't covered that you'd like to talk about or share while you're on the show?
I guess one thing that comes to mind, you know, I don't know your audience super well, but I sort of wonder for some of them, if they're individuals who are listening, some of them might be interested in getting into angel investing and how to do that. And I might, you know, want to comment a little bit on that.
Sure, please.
Arena. Yeah. I mean, I guess I would say, you know, for people who are interested in getting
getting into angel investing. You know, it's, any sort of investing is inherently risky. That's why it's an investment, not a sure thing. You know, but I would tell people, like, you know, really get to know the founders. I had a friend of mine actually recently who started getting into angel investing, and he showed me this email thing that he had between him and this founder.
Yeah.
And I didn't like the tone that the founder was using in the email. There's something really smarmy about it. And I said, have you met with the founder, like, in person to talk about this? And the person wants to write, like, a 10K check or something. Mm-hmm. He's like, oh, we met once, but we haven't met since then. And I was like, I don't think you're doing this right. And I was like, you know, that to me, if you're investing in something, you want to put in the, you know, highest bandwidth type of connection you can have with someone. And to me, that means like being in person with them on the phone, video chat, something like that. Don't do your investing like through email channels. I think that is, that's a poor form way to do it. And I think there are things that you're going to pick up on and you're going to have a better conversation whether or not you invest when it's like real time like that with someone. You know, I think it's interesting. I think it can be helpful to invest in people that you like know and trust because you know and trust them. On the other side, if you can't be objective about it and like the investment goes south and it's a fund of yours, that can be really difficult. So I think there are sort of pros and cons to all these different things. Yeah, I don't know. I just want to mention angel investing for a second. I don't have any like super high level stuff, but
yeah.
The other thing I guess I would say about angel investing is like I think the best angel investors are people who have expertise sort of in a field and they sort of want to mentor and help a team out. Going back to this relationship piece a little bit, it's like if you can work with the team for a couple of months and you know, maybe you have technical expertise, maybe you have leadership expertise, and you can work with them, then you're going to get a much better feel of like, hey, should I write that 25K check or not, and go from there.
Interesting. And if people want to find out more about your fund, do you have information online?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah, absolutely. People can go to 1517fund.com. 1517 also has a Medium page. We're on Twitter. We're only lightly on Facebook. People can email me at danielle@1517fund.com. And like I said earlier, we're really accessible. So happy to hear from any of your listeners. And for any of your listeners who are like hesitant, just send us a note. Just say like, hey, I heard you on the podcast and I just wanted to say hi. I mean, we've had conversations with people who they're like, I don't even know quite what I want to talk about yet, but I just wanted to reach out. We're like, sure, that's cool.
Yeah. Well, you know what? If you want to send me an email with just like some links and stuff, and I could just get it up in the show notes when I put it up.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Awesome.
Well, thanks for having me on today.
Yeah, it was a pleasure to have you on, and I'm really glad we were able to connect.
Yeah. Likewise.
Cool. And keep me posted with how things go.
Yeah, we'll do.
Awesome. Well, have a great rest of your day.
Likewise.
Thank you. See ya.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast with Eric Schlein. If you'd like to connect with Eric for questions, comments, feedback, ideas, or to inquire about being on the show, please contact Eric at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. So, in the words of Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.